I knew the jacket would not last for long today, so I didn't even come with the tie. I want to remind us all that children of all ages are welcome to remain with us through our worship service. But if you're family or children, apparently not. There you go. If your children or your family want or desire a separate time and space, please follow the procession, follow Ruth into the family room, and they will return to join us to commune with us later. I ask you to pray with me, please. God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be a delight in your sight. God, you who are our rock, our strength, our redeemer. Amen. One of the questions that is wisely asked during pre-wedding counseling for many couples and in many occasions, it's a good question, not even if you're in pre-wedding counseling. So I'm going to ask that you share with a neighbor, someone you may not know terribly well or someone that you may know well. Take a couple moments and share with someone else about this question. How did your family of origin handle disagreements and conflicts? Meddling right off the bat. How did your family of origin handle disagreements and conflicts? So just take a couple of minutes, turn to someone, and share what you're willing to share and hear what they're able to share. So if the other person has not yet shared, try to transition to having the other share. So obviously that is a topic that we could share about for quite a long time. So this sharing can continue later, but it will stop for now. Okay. The sharing is not over, but it will stop for the moment. So did anyone hear about a family that handled disagreement and conflict differently than their own? Yeah, there are at least a few of those. Just like our differing, quote, love languages, that in which we communicate and receive love, that we know that we are expressing and that we recognize that we are receiving love, our ways of handling disagreements and conflicts differ. Again, it's probably that mysterious combination of our natural disposition or our culture, but almost certainly, much more so, our families of origin that have shaped how we respond to disagreements and conflicts. You know, in households that may have been emotionally or physically abusive, any disagreement or conflict may have been met with swift and severe retribution. There was good reason to be afraid if you felt conflict in the room. So there may be a kind of hypervigilance to detect any hint of disagreement. It was a hazard from which you protected yourself. And there are other families that would have what appeared to be a full-on knockdown, drag-out verbal war at the dinner table. Yet in the morning, everything was actually okay. And there are other families that only any open expression of anger or displeasure was censored, or it was shamed. It was silenced as, quote, a bad emotion that was not to be expressed. Not that there still wasn't anger or conflict or disagreement. It just went underground. It probably came out in passive-aggressive responses, like quiet digging sideways comments or indirect actions as reprisals and punishments. Any of those sound familiar to any families in which we grew up? One of them is mine, ish. My second partner, with whom I was partnered for 8 years, he and I had very different disagreement styles. Now, we would often have very long and lively and interesting discussions about differing opinions on things like politics, but especially religion. He grew up K through 12 in Catholic school, which did not have the intended result, we'll say, but not an uncommon outcome. So he was not a big fan of church, although he remained a person of faith, not a big fan of church, and well, here I am. So in our long and lively discussions about religion, very often I would observe his volume getting louder and louder, his gestures would become more animated, and his face would even redden. And I would ask, "Why are you getting so angry?" And he would laugh and he would say, "I'm not angry, we're just having a discussion." That's not what it looked like in my family. But it is what it looked like in his family. Now, I had no reason to be afraid that he might actually harm me, but the energy and the edge in his persona and his voice and his behavior led me over time to actually become far more cautious and less willing to engage in those so-called discussions. Disagreements and conflicts. When there are at least two people in a room, there are at least two different ideas about how things are or how things should be that are coming into conflict with one another. Sometimes there can be one person in a room and two or three ideas about it. There's a saying probably in every religious tradition, and we'll steal it for MCC. You have 10 MCCers in the room, and you'll probably have 20 different opinions about anything. So, there will always be more than one perspective and opinion on a matter and the desired outcomes or who's right, who's wrong. And when they come into contact with one another, there will be disagreement and conflict. It's natural. It will happen. It's true in our personal relationships, it's true in our professional settings, in our workplaces, and guess what? It's true in churches too. I remember a pastor describing one of her pre-wedding counselings with a couple that had been together, two women who had been together for probably 18 to 20 years at the time that they were preparing to have a holy union. At that time, it was before there was legal same-sex marriage. And she describes asking them the question, "So what is it like when you argue?" And they looked at each other and it was like, "We have never had an argument ever in all those years." And the pastor gently warned them, "Well, if you've never had an argument in all these years, when you have your first argument, it's going to be a doozy." And not that this given pastor was a prophet, that's exactly what happened. Not too far in the future after they had their holy union, they eventually had their first fight and broke up. Not because of the holy union, but because they had never dealt with conflict and disagreement. Today is the fourth of five sermons that explore the core concept in Christian faith and practice, and indeed what is at the heart of all of the great religions of the world. Because when we set aside all the many things about which we disagree, we all agree that it is all about love. We Christians confidently affirm the twofold command given us by Christ that, yes, we love God and we love our neighbors as ourselves. And sometimes we also remember to affirm, yes, we strive to love our, quote, enemies as well. But why doesn't it look like that all so often to us and to others? It sounds simple, simple guideline, but it turns out to be not so simple at all, and we fall short so very often because we don't necessarily know what love looks like. The first problem arises when we consider and define love a thing, a feeling, an emotion, a noun, and when we fail to remember that it is a verb. Love is an action, is an action word. And it's not just that our feelings of love are irrelevant or unimportant, but it's the applications, the doing of the loving that matters. And another way we miss the mark in loving is we sometimes aim at different targets. We use different, quote, love languages, ways of expressing and receiving love due to our nature or our nurture. And we fail to communicate love because we do not speak the same languages of love. And last week, one of the most obvious and indeed most destructive ways that we miss the mark on loving is in our speech. How it is word by word that we will build a world of love or a world of pain and heartache. It can be through half-truths of rumors and innuendo, the destructive potential of gossip, and that letter of James that we looked at last week so pointedly instructs us that the tongue, being such a small thing, is capable of such great destruction, and the careful use of it necessary for those of us who wish to love. So where else do we miss that mark in loving one another? It is in the ways that we are with one another when we disagree or experience conflict. I heard a joke a number of months ago, and other than the traditional Easter joke, I am not much of a joke teller. You can probably attest to that even from Easter as well. But I heard a joke a few months ago that really applies. There is a story of a man who was a lone survivor on a desert island. And after many, many, many years, he was rescued. He was, of course, no doubt thrilled to be rescued. But when he was showing his rescuers around the small island where he had spent all those many, many, many years, he pointed out, they noticed that there were three huts on the island. And they inquired, well, there's only one person here, so why are there three different huts? And he explained, well, that is the hut that I live in. That is the hut that I sleep in and do all of, you know, the stuff to get out of the weather. And that hut over there is my church, the church that I go to. And they asked, well, what's the third hut? And he said, oh, that was my first church. There was a conflict in the church, and I had to leave. It's funny because it has the ring of truth, and it's not so funny because it has a sting of truth for any of us who have spent much time in church. Because when it comes to conflicts in communities and in relationships, sometimes we do what's called in recovery terms, quote, pull a geographic. That we will relocate without resolving the actual issue. And the funny thing about pulling a geographic is wherever you go, there you find yourself. Wherever you go, there you are. But here is a piece of good news. to borrow another 12-step expression, God meets us where we are, but does not leave us as we are. That's good news. One of my favorite seminary professors was, in fact, the professor who taught church administration and leadership. And he had a favorite phrase that he would find occasion to repeat sometime in nearly every class that I had him. We might be doing case studies from churches, we might be dealing with an issue in current events, and his phrase was this, this conflict will not undo us. This conflict will not undo us. Undergirded by that belief, which was reflected in the prayer of Julian, that if we truly believe that we belong to one another, the bonds may strain, there may be pain, but they need not break. Sadly, that will sometimes happen. But does it happen before we have prayerfully considered this conflict will not undo us? The excerpt that we heard from the Gospel according to Matthew this morning is very well known. Many parts of it are very well known. It is, of course, part of a larger teaching of Jesus. And it begins with what is quite truly the classic instruction on direct dealing and clear communications, particularly in churches, direct dealing and clear communication. In fact, there are churches and denominations even that use this as their guiding principle, their core principle around conflict resolution, peace skills, and communication covenants. And it instructs very clearly, if a sister or brother, if someone offends or sins, or if there's a breach in that relationship between you or someone else, you go to the person first privately, and you point it out. If they receive it, you have regained. You have regained that one, restoration of relationship. However, if they do not receive, you go with one or two others along with. And if they still do not receive, you go to the church. And even still, if they do not receive, three opportunities to restore that relationship in that way. And if after those three attempts, they are released, in gospel terms, considered a tax collector or a Gentile, we would use different words, but they are released from the ties that bind them as community. It's hard to think of how that happens, but very clear instruction. Now, as an aside, to the careful observer, you'll notice that the mention of the word church in this Jesus quote is rather telling, because the church did not, in fact, exist during the lifetime of Jesus. So Matthew is, in fact, recording what was already a conflict resolution instruction in the early Christian church some 40 years after the life and death of Jesus. And he attributes it to Jesus, places it on the lips of Jesus, because it was so consistent with what they knew of the person and the teaching and the good news of Jesus Christ in the Gospels. It is as if Jesus would have said this himself, based upon the witness of the good news. And you know, it's really interesting how much of Christian scripture, the letters of Paul, in nearly every case, are addressing some community in conflict, confronting, smoothing over some kind of disagreement in the church that he has planted. Turn to any letter of Paul's. That letter of James last week that speaks so clearly, takes no prisoners about an inconsistency between what one professes and what one does. You know, those things about which we would prefer to say very little in public, in church, like money, like the poor, like conflict, the scripture actually says quite a lot. Perhaps we should pay attention to what's being said. So how do we show love when we disagree, when we experience a conflict? I'm going to cue up some slides. Thank you, Dylan. So imagine person A, person B. There is some conflict or misunderstanding that occurs, and it's not unusual. It is a natural occurrence. Something need not be wrong for there to be this uncertainty or this breach between person A and person B. Now, what often happens, what too often happens, is rather than A and B dealing with one another, they replace the question with C, another person. And it's a little hard to see right there. This is what's called a pass-through communication. There's something that A wants to say to B, so it goes through person C. Now, A communicates to person C, and then notice C communicates to person B, but it's never quite exactly the same. Now, the classic example, now sometimes it can be perfectly benign, and let's face it, sometimes it's really convenient. Classic example is telling someone, would you tell your partner blah blah? Benign, convenient, but you know, too often, like that childhood game of telephone, it creates confusion because there's some detail that's going to be lost in the translation. And because the two parties aren't actually communicating, the question and the breach does not go away. It just proliferates. It just proliferates. It doesn't address the issue. It increases the issue. Another way that we do this is when we substitute the question for another person, but it's not a pass-through. Oh, it's hard to see the arrows there. And that is called triangulation. Anyone who's been in therapy, anyone who's been in a helping profession knows all about triangulation. It's not terribly unlike pass-through communication, but it has a twist because it's a both way, but never between the parties that actually have the breach. It's a pass-through different direction. You know, I could not even begin to estimate the number of times people have come to me and said, did you know this person did thus and such? What are you going to do about it? Person C, you know, person A says, person B did this. What am I going to do about it? An example that I recall several years ago, just a few minutes before our morning worship began, someone came to me and mentioned that a very large truck was parked occupying both of the handicapped spaces in front of our building. They asked me, did I know that there was a big truck and was it supposed to be there? I said, I don't know. Did you ask? And this was brought to my attention by someone who actually is not very withdrawn and is very clear, it speaks very boldly in many occasions. Just one of many examples where a communication between A and B would not have required a communication with C. I'm not in charge of the parking. I actually have no greater authority to tell someone where they can and cannot park in a public parking space. By the way, they did in fact have a handicap sticker, but it was a really large vehicle. So, we have triangles. Now, again, triangulation never addresses the issue because the breach still exists. It just is a proliferation of the issues. Now, I actually think these pass-through and triangulating communications are further complicated by social media, don't you think? What if C is Facebook? Well, persons C through W read it, but X, Y, and Z might actually need to know about it, but didn't see it, and B isn't even on Facebook at all. Well, everybody knows, except the person who actually needs to know the information, or about whom the issue revolves. So, next. If we replace the issue and the question into a conversation that actually happens between two parties, there's far more clarity, far less opportunity. The two parties are relating to each other and not through somebody else. Now, I will add, there may be important exceptions to this first-person communication in cases where there has been a severe and traumatic breach that needs facilitation or mediation to create any condition to proceed. In situations where there may have been a history of abuse, either verbal or physical, on the part of one of the parties, where there may be a pattern of some kind of disorder or pathology at work, or some well-founded reason that violence might erupt, then no, a go-between is actually pretty wise. But in the majority of our cases, I would say 90% of the time, our interpersonal conflicts could be resolved by, next, courageous, first-person, truth-filled communications. I took that from Healthy Disclosure, Kibby Ruth and Karen McClintock. Courageous, first-person, truth-filled communications, because it boils down to this. Persons who initiate indirect communications seldom take responsibility for the accuracy of the information or for the integrity of the relationship with the other person. Persons using direct communication take personal responsibility for their own thoughts and feelings and relationships. Indirect communication is avoidance of relationship. And relationships are hard work, aren't they? No one likes to be told that they may have hurt someone. Most of us prefer to think that absolutely everybody agrees with what we have said and done. Am I right? And yes, it is hard and it is emotionally uncomfortable, but being uncomfortable is not dangerous. In fact, being uncomfortable, sometimes even painfully so, is the only way that we grow. Being uncomfortable is not dangerous. Being uncomfortable is the only way we grow. So the question is, are we more committed to maintaining a comfortable distance from one another, or creating a community of authentic relationships? Are we more committed to maintaining comfortable distance or creating authentic relationships? At its core, communication that is done directly and lovingly is loving someone else as we wish to be loved ourselves. Because avoidance withholds that chance for growth and learning. It denies even ourselves the opportunity for growth and change. It extinguishes the possibility for God's transformation in that relationship. It is an avoidance of the potential for love. I want to return to the final verse that we heard in that passage from Matthew today. It's probably far more famous than any of the verses that precede it. Where two or three are gathered in my name, I am there among them. Where two or three are gathered in my name, I am there among them. I most often, and perhaps all of us, have most often heard that stated in a situation where there's a small group praying, or perhaps a disappointing attendance at an event or some gathering where two or three are gathered. But when we place it back in the original context in which we find it here, the two or three gathered are not gathered for praise or for worship or for prayer. The two or three are gathered in the discomfort, even the anxiety of facing their differences, their disagreements, in the middle of conflict. And when we shrink from those hard places, we shrink from a place where Jesus has promised to meet us. When we place this in its original context, it is